and that is the reason that I did this talk. I am not from Washington originally. I'm a transplant. I'm actually, about split 50-50 between the East Coast and the West Coast. I've been out here since about 2008 on the West Coast, but about half of that time has been down in San Diego. So I've moved around a lot as far as pursuing marine biology careers. I've been a naturalist for about 10 years or so. But I moved to Washington because I really loved Washington. Most people move to Washington because they really love Florida in this state. And so I'm not ashamed to say, they're my least favorite. nothing against them, I certainly respect them, but maybe I've just already cheered for the underdog. And, you know, in a place where everyone, you know, is orcas, I really want to kind of put the spotlight on a really great story that is happening right now in our local waters that a lot of people, even people in this room that are, you know, whale fanatics, might not be aware of the scale of what's going on out there as far as the humpback populations and their return to this area. So today I'll be talking a little bit about the history of humpback whales in the Salish Sea, what we're observing now as far as behaviors go, as well as what this kind of means moving forward, how we deal with this new population of humpback whales in an environment that's not used to them being here. So first and foremost, I am assuming that most of you in this room are familiar with humpback whales, but if not, this is who we're talking about here today. Humpback whales, considered to be a medium-ish large baleen whale, about 40 to 50 feet in length, 50 to 80,000 pounds, lifespan similar to our own, about 80 plus years. Not surprised if we find that they live to be 100 plus years. And as far as diet goes, varied. Krill, other crustaceans that are in the water column, as well as many different species of bait fish. The other thing we kind of need to know going to this talk is, what is the Salish Sea? When I refer to that body of water, what am I talking about? So the Salish Sea is going to encompass the Strait of Georgia, the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and Puget Sound. So those are interconnected waterways, separate but all part of a very important ecosystem. The phrase Salish Sea was coined by Bert Weber back in 1989 as a way to try to conserve those interconnected waterways more easily. So back in the 70s and 80s, a lot of industrialization was happening, a lot of development, and when they were writing legislation as far as, you know, setting up protective measures towards these different areas, they would, you know, maybe protect the Puget Sound. They would mention the Strait of Georgia. Well, that's great, but those waterways are all connected, and so protecting just one wouldn't necessarily save, you know, all of the other animals that are in that same ecosystem. And so he thought that if you just give that entire area a name, that when you're, you know, writing protective measures, you can protect the whole area more easily. That was the idea anyway. It did take a while to catch on. It was, like I said, coined in 89, not officially adopted by the U.S. Board of Geographic Names until 2009. And I would say there's still not a lot of widespread understanding of what that body of water is. I think people hear it, but they don't necessarily know what it's referring to. So that's that, and the name comes from the Coast Salish people, which was actually many different populations, but they all shared a similar Coast Salish language, so that's kind of his homage to them. They were the original inhabitants of those inland waters. So when I'm referring to the humpback of the Salish Sea, I'm referring specifically to humpbacks that are found in that region. As far as the history of humpbacks in the Salish, humpback whale bones have been found in archaeological sites on the Olympic Peninsula dating back at least 1,500 years. That is a very conservative estimate. I'm sure it's even longer, but that was the one that I was kind of confident sticking with. So we know that, you know, some hunting was going on for a very long time. However, they were using canoes, they were using handheld harpoons. It was occurring at a very sustainable rate. It was not until industrialized whaling came along that the humpback population here really started to decrease dramatically. So steamships, exploding harpoons, things of that nature. And actually, as far as the Salish Sea goes, we saw the disappearance of humpback whales in the early 1900s. And if you were in the room when Uko and I were talking earlier, that's before they even really got things started elsewhere. So they were removed from this ecosystem very, very early on. Even though we didn't have humpbacks really in the Salish Sea since the early 1900s, it was still legal to commercially hunt humpbacks all the way until 1966, when the International Whaling Commission banned that. And that was just for humpbacks specifically. International Whaling Commission's ban on commercial whaling didn't actually happen until the 80s. So that is very recent, a lot more recent than I think a lot of folks realize. By the end of that industrial whaling era, the population in the entire North Pacific was estimated at potentially as low as just 1,000 humpback whales. So they, you know, unfortunately don't have a lot of good numbers as to the population before whaling, because again, they were removed before they even really started counting. So we don't really know what the population was before, but we know that by the early 1900s, it was essentially zero. As far as post-whaling humpback sightings, since that commercial whaling stopped in the 60s, there were a few very sporadic sightings here in Puget Sound, 1976, 78, 86, when Cascadia Research Collective started up down in Olympia back in the late 80s. They observed two different humpback whales. There's two photos up there, flukes, in the very, very southern portion of Puget Sound. They were here for about a month's time, and you can see really all the way down there to Olympia, so really deep down into Puget Sound. And then they left, so they're here for about a month, and they actually weren't here at the same time. One was here for a couple weeks, and then they switched. But that was pretty much it. So very, very rare to see humpback whales here in Salish Sound, or sorry, Salish Sea, and those ones were specifically in Puget Sound. In 1997, a humpback whale was sighted off of Victoria by Mark Mallison, who is a whale watching captain for Prince of Wales out of Victoria. And he was so excited to be out there and finally get a picture of a humpback whale that he sent the picture to the newspaper in Victoria, and they refused to publish it because they thought that it had been doctored. That's how rare it was to see humpback whales in this area. But it was not doctored. It was a very real humpback whale. She returned again in 1999. Again in 2003, and she has returned every single year since then. Her number is BCY0324, but she is much more affectionately known as Big Mama in this region, and that is because she has brought calves with her in 2003, 2006, 10, 12, 14, and her most recent calf was in 2016. So she's brought at least 6 calves here since she was first sighted. We thought if she was going to be sticking to that pattern that 2018 would have been another calf year. She did not show up with the calf, so fingers crossed maybe 2019, but she's again one of the oldest and most beloved whales here that we observe in this area. Just to kind of continue on that, since her first initial sightings have really increased markedly over the last several years. We currently have more than 400 individuals documented in the Salish Sea. It doesn't necessarily mean that all 400 of them are here, just that we have photographed at least 400 different individuals. And the entire North Pacific population is now estimated at about 21,000. So if you remember, I said at the end of industrial whaling, we thought maybe as few as 1,000, so that's a really great increase. The idea being, as the population in general is increasing, they're filtering in to find new feeding grounds, and that's what led them to discover this area. This chart is from Cascadia Research. I mentioned them earlier down in Olympia. They do a lot of our local humpback research here. You can see in the 90s, virtually no sightings, maybe a couple. In the early 2000s, you were up to maybe 50 sightings a year or so. Things really exploded 10 years ago. 2009, we had about 250 humpback sightings. And then 2014, 5 years ago, nearly 600 sightings, a sighting being an individual report of a humpback whale. So you can see it was increasing, but really, really spiked there about 5 years ago. This chart stopped in 2015. I can tell you I'm pretty confident that it would continue on this trajectory right now, because the company that I work for, Island Adventures, we alone had 258 humpback sightings last year. And we are just one company. That's between April 21st and November 23rd is what our humpback sightings were, the first one being the 21st of April, which is usually about when they start to show up. This is the time. I just spoke to some folks that were out on the water today, and they saw a humpback whale today. So it's starting to trickle in. And then they actually, some will stay throughout the winter. Weather here in the winter is not always cooperative, so we don't necessarily run year-round, but our last humpback whale sighting of 2018 was on November 23rd. So you can see a huge portion of these are going to be in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, a few in Puget Sound, a few up towards the southern end of the Strait of Georgia. But the reason that you see sightings in this area is because that's where our boat can reach. There's other boats that leave from other locations, such as Vancouver. They see tons of humpback whales up in the northern portion of the Strait of Georgia as well. And for the companies that operate at Puget Sound, they're also pretty frequent, not quite in those numbers, but there's several whales that actually kind of prefer to hang out down near Puget Sound. So I think that those numbers on that chart certainly are higher than they were back in 2014. Why are they here? Well, humpback whales are a migratory species, so they are going to be feeding in cooler waters, and then in the winter time, for the most part, they travel to warmer waters to either breed, or if they are pregnant, that is where they go to give birth. It's about a year-long gestation, so they're on that cycle, either going down to breed or going down to give birth. As far as the length of that migration, it is certainly one of the longest mammal migrations on Earth, about 10 to 12,000 miles. Every couple of years, gray whales and humpback whales kind of take the lead. They're neck and neck. Right now, the record belongs to one specific female gray whale at about 14,000 miles round trip, coming from the Arctic and all the way down to Baja, the Russian Arctic. But I would not be surprised if a humpback whale has also done a very long migration.
Well, one gray whale made it to Namibia.
Oh, well, that's true. I'm not including the outliers. Good point. But very long migrations. This figure comes from what is known as the SPLASH study, which happened several years ago, which was a huge collaborative effort. Many, many scientists involved, lots of photo identification, trying to figure out what are those migration patterns of humpbacks. Prior to that study, we made an awful lot of assumptions. All of the Alaska whales swim to Hawaii, for example. All of the Mexico whales swim to California. Well, the SPLASH study showed us that that was definitely not true. It was a lot more fluid than we had anticipated. They don't always go where we thought. And so that was kind of the first opening into the fact that those migration routes might be a little bit more complex than we anticipated. Building on the SPLASH study is Happy Whale. Raise your hand if you're familiar with Happy Whale. Okay. I'm seeing enough hands nod up that I'm going to go ahead and explain this from scratch. If you are not familiar with Happy Whale, I'm going to give them a huge plug right now because they are doing amazing, amazing stuff. Happy Whale started in 2014 by Ted Cheeseman. It's actually part of his PhD project. And he essentially wanted to create one central humpback database. Up until this point, there were a lot of independent research projects happening, a lot of independent catalogs that had been made, Alaska, the Northeast, in California, Hawaii, things like that, but the notes were not being shared. Not necessarily, because they were being kept secret, but just, didn't even think about sharing them sometimes. And so he really wanted to open that up so that everyone had access to the information. And so the way that Happy Whale works is if you take a photograph of a humpback whale's fluke, which is, individuals are gonna all have a unique fluke pattern that stays pretty consistent throughout their life. So if you're able to get a photo of the underside, you upload it to Happy Whale, which is just a website. You start an account, happywhale.com, and they will run that through all of the ID guides. They will also cross-reference it against any other photos that have been submitted. So if anyone else in the world has seen the whale that you have just photographed, it will send you a match. It will tell you where and when that whale was seen. And the really cool thing is that it will also send you updates in the future if that whale is ever seen again. So every couple of days, I'll get a nice long email telling me, where my favorite whales are. So that's really cool. And again, Ted's idea was that if you made that fun and interactive, more people would be inclined to participate, which is great. It raises awareness about humpback whales, but it also does a lot of his work for him. So great, it's a win-win. They've only been around since 2014. They already have 22,000 individuals identified, which is estimated to be about a quarter of the world's population. So the more photos you submit, the better we will have an understanding of their processes. He wanted me to tell you, I just talked to him a couple hours ago, that they just updated their algorithm, so it's even more accurate. And so don't be shy if you don't have a perfect photo. They're able to make some pretty incredible matches. I have submitted pictures, their whales on a side, and all you can see is about that much of the tail. They can make matches, okay? So don't let that deter you. Just upload it, and if that whale has been seen before, you'll get an update, which is really cool. I'll show you some examples. Big Mama, that whale that I was talking about earlier, she, thanks to the SPLASH study, which was that initial study back in the 2000s, as well as with Happy Whale, we know her to be part of the Hawaii breeding population. And she was seen off of Lahaina, Hawaii, as recently as March 19th of this year, so less than a month ago. She's usually, traditionally, one of the first whales to show up in this area, usually about early April. So when I got this update a couple of weeks ago, I was super glad to know that she'd been seen in Hawaii. I was also bummed because I knew that she would probably be a little bit late arriving because it takes usually at least 30 days if they're doing a really direct course. And I have a feeling that she's going to be traveling at a more leisurely pace than that. So probably a couple more weeks before she shows up, who knows. But we do at least know that she made it to Hawaii this year. So we have a good representation of our population so far that has been matched to the Hawaii breeding grounds. However, we also have a pretty good number of whales that have been matched to the Mexico breeding ground. One of them is another one of our very recognizable whales here, Split Fluke. She is a female. She has you can't see in this picture, but a little notch in her fluke, Split Fluke. But she's been matched down to the Mexico breeding ground. In 2009, she was spotted off of Jalisco, Mexico. So that's kind of cool. We have two different breeding grounds that are choosing to feed in a central location. Now with humpback whales, it stands to reason that if you are born in Mexico, you will probably also give birth in Mexico. You return to the breeding grounds that you know. And that proved true for Split Fluke's calf, Valiant, which was born in 2016, early 2017. It was first spotted in the summer of 2017. But Valiant have also been matched to the Mexico breeding grounds off of Cabo San Lucas in both 2018 and 2019. So that's where Valiant was born. It's where Valiant seems to be returning in the winter. This is a really cool update. I hold this whale pretty close to my heart. We were among the first ones to spot this whale. But again, you can't see in this little picture, but had a rough start at life. Missing both tips of the flukes completely. Covered in rake marks from orcas, so clearly had a very, very traumatic experience with orcas early on in life, but hung on and managed to make it down to the breeding grounds 2 years in a row. So that's another one of our sailed sea whales. So, like this, makes sense. That's where you're born. You swim up to the feeding grounds with your mom. You stop nursing. You kind of learn the ropes, how to feed, and then you travel back down to where you came from. Makes sense. Not always true. this came about just a couple of weeks ago, actually. So Stripe is another one of our humpback whales. In 1997, was photographed off of Lahaina, Hawaii. In 2017, photographed near Loreto, Mexico. Even though the photograph was in 2017, it was not actually submitted and processed until just a few weeks ago. So we didn't know about that until just recently. So started off going back and forth between Hawaii, seems like recently going back and forth to Mexico. Not sure why that would be, kind of bounced it off a few folks. We wonder if maybe Stripe is a male and, maybe exhausted all of his options in Hawaii, trying to spread his seed, in a new spot. That's purely speculation until we get a DNA sample. We don't know, but that could stand to reason, not sure. But again, like that SPLASH study showed us, it might not be as rigid as we once thought. Seems like there's some flexibility there with those migrations. But this is a screenshot of the notification that you get. So when your whale is spotted, you'll get and these are all interactive. You can click on them and see what time and date and all that good stuff, as well as the actual picture from that sighting. Okay, so as I mentioned, I used to first, before moving to Washington, live in Southern California. And in San Diego, we saw humpback whales fairly regularly in the spring and the fall in transit. So not feeding, not breeding, they're just passing through. So usually we would just have a single sighting with a humpback whale, never see it again. Maybe it would stick around for a couple of days, a week at most. But I really didn't have any opportunity to observe social behavior because they just weren't there for long enough. The really neat thing about being here is that they're sticking around for, you know, 6 months at a time. So we're able to kind of get a glimpse into what their life looks like on a daily basis. What we found so far is that when we do see humpbacks here, they are either alone or, I would venture to say, more often in pairs. And those pairs are consistent. So they'll form these relationships with known associates. The word friend, I know, is very touchy in the scientific community. be careful. But I will say that these are very intelligent animals. They are clearly making intelligent decisions as to which animals they associate with and which they don't. And that's pretty darn close to what a friend is. So. But for now, we'll call them known associates. Some of them will be consistent just throughout a single season. Some of them will be season after season after season. They are consistently with that whale year after year. One example is a pair of females. One is Heather, and the other is Divot. And my first season here was actually the 2016 season. I moved up here late 2015. But in going back through the records, Heather and Divot were together side by side like this. This is them. All of 2015, all of 2016, all of 2017. In 2018, last year, Divot had a calf with her when she came back. And Heather was nowhere to be seen. So Divot spent the entire summer alone with just her and her calf, not interacting with other animals. So Heather had to find a new associate. And so we found that she was choosing to hang out with a whale known as Raptor. And so throughout the entire summer, they were seen side by side. Another example is our duo of Split Fin and Split Fluke. Split Fin has a split in the dorsal fin, very original name here. And then Split Fluke, we talked about earlier, has the split in her fluke. They are interesting because they were both born in 2006. So they were the class of 2006. Split Fin is the calf of Big Mama. Split Fluke is a calf of Heather, the whale that we just talked about. And we actually thought that they were both males because so long had passed that we never saw them, either one, come back with a calf. So they were regularly seen, much predating me. I went back through the records at least yearly together every single year since 2011, and I'm sure possibly even before that. But at least 2011 on, they were with each other every single summer. Until 2017, 2 years ago, Split Fluke had a calf, Valiant, the one we talked about earlier. For the rest of 2017, Split Fluke was with her calf alone, off doing their own thing. Split Fin seemed mostly alone, didn't find another partner that year. Partner, not necessarily the right word, but didn't have another travel buddy that year. Seemed mostly alone. And during last year, 2018, Split Fin associated with a whale known as Zigzag, not Split Fluke anymore. So this is obviously a very small sample size and not a very long period of time, but something clearly happened in that year that they had a calf. What I'd be curious to see as we do go forward is if after a couple of years they return to those same, you know, kind of relationships that they used to have consistently. Only time will tell. But again, just two examples of those kind of pairings that we see pretty regularly.
How long will the calf stay with the mother?
So if you read a textbook, a baleen whale is very different than, say, you know, a toothed whale like an orca or some of the other dolphins. Instead of staying together for life, for the baleen whales, they're usually just with that calf until they're weaned. So for humpback whales, it could be about 10 months or so. I have read of babies staying with their mom a little bit past that mark, maybe into a second year, but that's pretty much all. So not a very long time, usually a year or less. As far as some other interesting behavior that we've been able to observe in this area, one of them is humpback whale interactions with killer whales. In 2016, there was a really good Bob Pittman and Company paper that came out just explaining about dozens and dozens of these interactions where humpback whales interfered with killer whale hunting. And it was only, honestly, about 2 weeks after the paper was published that we observed some of that out in the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So we had some mammal-eating orcas that were going after a stellar sea lion, which is a brown lump here. And while they were trying to get the sea lion, there were actually three sea lions there, but as they were trying to hunt the sea lion, a group of four humpback whales came over and started to get in the way. They were splashing around. They would cut in between the orcas and the sea lions, trumpeting loudly and splashing, really causing a scene. And eventually, after about 20 minutes or so, the orcas gave up, swam away in one direction, humpback whales swam away in another direction, sea lions wisely swam away with the humpback whales. But they broke it up. I mean, the orcas did not get a meal at that time. And the title of the paper refers to this as interspecific altruism. I've talked with a couple of folks since then, most recently with Fred Sharp, who does a lot of humpback behavior stuff up in Alaska, about his thoughts on that. And are they really genuinely doing this out of the goodness of their heart to benefit another species? And he said he didn't really think so. I think this is one of the things that we'll just never be able to prove. But he thought that it might even go beyond that. They're not trying to help the sea lion, they're trying to help themselves. Because orcas are predators of humpback whales. And so if you can prevent something that's trying to eat you from eating, maybe in the long run, you are helping yourself. And so that might be it, too. It might not be altruism. It might be very, very, you know, forward-thinking selfishness. But like that, I just don't know that we'll ever know. But we have definitely seen this on more than one occasion. But this is one of the more notable ones that we did have a photograph of them preventing orcas from eating.
Erin, is that the one that Orion was part of?
Yes, Orion was one of them. Please don't ask me the other three, because I do not know. Legal. Yeah.
I also remember hearing stories about divers that I thought it was maybe a humpback whale, like a whale would come over and kind of like be around the diver, and then the diver would eventually get out of the water and see a shark nearby, and they felt like the whale was trying to help them. So is that humpback whale?
Well, I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but okay. I know the case you're talking about. I'm not entirely sure that I'm convinced that it was a shark. I think that that diver was really close to that whale and needed a story to explain why they were really close. Because I watched that video many times and I don't see a shark anywhere.
Okay.
It certainly could be true. I mean, there's reports of dolphins, you know, being with divers to scare sharks away and things like that. But yeah, in that specific case, I'm not sure if I buy that. But it could be, if any of you know her, you know, I apologize. But that's just my interpretation of that case. So as far as other interesting behavior that we see, this is another theory that we get to put into action. In 2010, a paper came out of Australia that theorized that during inclement weather, so high wind conditions, humpback whales seem to be more surface active. And the theory was that when it's really windy, there's a lot of underwater sound, and maybe those vocalizations that the humpbacks are typically using aren't as effective. So they need some punctuation. And so breaching, tail flapping, pec flapping, things like that are going to be short sounds, so you're not, you know, as much information being communicated, but maybe effective, you know, here I'm over here, something like that. Don't know, again, if that's true, but I can tell you for sure that humpback whales are more surface active when it is windy out there. We see lots more breaching, lots more tail flapping, lots more pec flapping when it's bumpy. Sometimes I wonder if it's just more fun for them to be honestly in those conditions, but if they do think that that has to do with communication, I can at least verify that we certainly see an increase in surface activity. Yeah.
Is it possible that if it's super wavy and windy, it's easier for them to get a clear breath if they're more fully out of the water like that?
You can write a paper. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's possible. I don't know. I really don't. They exhale so fast that I don't know that's necessarily. I mean, they can breathe it out and in so fast.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's.
To breathe to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking just like 2 seconds is all I need to be able to get that breath. So I don't know if that's it.
And the tail slap wouldn't.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, tail slapping and pec slapping wouldn't necessarily explain that. But yeah, we definitely see an increase in surface active behavior when we have, you know, passengers that are green and, you know, vomiting over the sides, it's so bumpy. This is at least the silver lining. It's breaching at least. Whereas on nice calm waves, they might not get to have that experience. feeding behavior here in the Salish Sea, just as they travel, so do they feed. So either alone or cooperatively in pairs. Most of the time when we do observe them feeding, it's going to be lunge feeding at the surface, which is what this whale's doing. You can see lots of little bait fish there, lots of birds interested as well. They're generalist feeders. It's one of the reasons that they've been able to really do well all over the world is they're not super picky. You know, if they can get a lot of it and it's small enough to fit in their mouth, then they will eat it. So krill, when I lived in San Diego, they ate a lot of those little red pelagic crabs. Up here, we see them eating a lot of bait fish. So they're not super picky. There's a researcher out of the University of Victoria right now, Rhonda Reedy, who is doing fecal samples on humpback whales to try to see exactly what they are eating. We are super excited that this year, if the opportunity arises, we are going to be scooping some poop to help that project along. You know, she said that it does not happen very often. All of last year, I think she collected 3 samples where she was actually in the right place at the right time for it to happen. But so we're going to keep a little kit on the boat, and if we happen to see some whales feeding and see some poop, we'll try to see if we can collect some of that for her so she can figure out what exactly they are feeding on. So far, she's only been able to analyze just a couple of samples, but she did find krill and also young pollock. Continuing with feeding behavior, every now and then we do observe them in very, very large aggregations. We've kind of, among the community, dubbed them herds. And this is happening especially in the late summer and fall months. So September, October, we'll sometimes have 50 or more humpback whales out there. Never on a day I'm working. I've actually, you know, so we see that mostly out of our Port Angeles location because it's farther out west in the Strait. But if they had a day like this, actually this is the picture that inspired me. I picked up, took a ferry over literally the next day, and they were gone. I mean, they were farther west. So I haven't been able to go out and experience these big herds. Some of the other whale watching boats that we talked to have had, they're pretty confident, at least 100 animals at a time. But again, it only lasts for a day or two, and then they kind of disperse again. But when we do see them feeding in those groups, we're not seeing group feeding behavior, if that makes sense. So they're feeding in the same spot, but they're not working together to feed. We have not yet observed bubble net feeding, which is one of the strategies that's pretty famous in Alaska, where the whales are, you know, blowing a bubble ring around the fish to kind of scare them up. That behavior has also been observed in some places off of northern Vancouver Island. Hasn't made its way down here yet. The other new craze that's sweeping the baleen whale nation is trap feeding. Any of you heard of the trap feeding yet? Okay, a couple of you. So they have observed this in Brutus whales in other parts of the world, and they've started to observe it in some humpback whales off of northern Vancouver Island. Essentially, the idea is that when there's a really close concentration of bait fish, lunge feeding is best because you're coming through really fast and you're just getting as much as you possibly can. The idea is that if there's not a high concentration of fish, it's more spread out, not as many animals, they're observing these humpback whales just kind of vertically floating with their mouths open like this for minutes. Every now and then the fish will come in, but they can't quite get over the, you know, lip of the jaw. So fish will just kind of trickle in, birds will kind of help guide them in, and then when the whale thinks that it has enough, it'll close its mouth like a Venus flytrap and kind of dive down. So it doesn't seem that efficient to me, but like I said, it's been observed in a couple of different places around the world now, so there must be some benefit. And the whales that are trap feeding are not exclusively trap feeding. Again, it seems to happen when the food is more spread out as opposed to when it's more concentrated. So that also has been observed off of North Vancouver Island. We haven't seen it down here yet. It is believed to be a learned behavior that's kind of, you know, passed down culturally. So we are definitely on the lookout for it. If it happens, it's really cool, but we haven't seen that yet. They seem to just be kind of traditionally lunge feeding at the surface. Or what we have seen, especially with these large groups, we think they're going down pretty deep. Because what we'll see is a group of maybe 5 to 10 whales will all go down together, stay down for about 10 to 15 minutes, which is pretty long for what we're usually seeing. They're usually down for, you know, 5 to 7 minutes when we're typically watching them. So they're going down on deeper dives, and then they'll all come up together and kind of log at the surface for several minutes, similar to what sperm whales do. So kind of, you know, reoxygenating their blood, but all just resting at the surface and then all diving down back again. No clue what's happening down there. That's another thing that Cascadia is trying to figure out, as well as Rhonda from University of Victoria. They're trying to see if they can get video cameras on them, see what's going on underwater. The little suction cup tags that have gyroscopes as well to see what their movements are underwater. We just know that they're gone for 10 to 15 minutes and then they all come up at the same time. So one of the things that I'm really personally interested in are those social connections between the whales. And one advantage that we have here by starting from a population that was virtually zero is that as these whales trickle in, as they reproduce, we know kind of where they came from and who they belong to. And so we've been able to document at least two cases of third generation whales. So one example is this whale here, whose grandma, this is Horizon. In 2010, she gave birth to a calf, Apollo. And last year, we saw Apollo with a calf that proved to be male, because he jumped up out of water at a very opportune moment. We were able to snap a shot, look under the hood, if you will, and he was a male. And so his name is Nova. That's one of those three generations. The other one that we have confirmed so far is Heather, Split, Fluke, and Valiant. They're the other one. So that's cool, and that ties into what I'm working on, which kind of goes to your question as well. How long do they associate with their moms? It's just something I'm curious about. It's kind of my pet project. I think it will take a long, long, long time to see if there's any patterns. But a lot of times we will see moms in very close proximity to their calves from previous seasons, but I've never seen them actually interacting. So when I say close, I don't mean, within a couple of miles. I mean they're within 400 yards of each other, but they're not interacting. I have a hard time believing that they don't know it's their calf, because, again, they choose these social partners year after year. They clearly recognize other whales. They're intelligent. I feel like they know that that's their baby from years previous, but they don't seem to be interacting. So, again, that's just something that I've been keeping track of. Every time we have a sighting, we will note which whales are present. And then throughout the day, if we go to a different area where other whales are, we'll note which whales are there. And I'm just kind of, trying to sift through that web, but I haven't caught them interacting at all, which is interesting to me. I would think that they would, but so far I haven't found any evidence of that, but it's what I'm kind of working on personally, is trying to see if they do have interactions after that first year. So what we're seeing here in the Salish Sea, as far as humpback increases go, is indicative of what's happening around the world. Humpback whales, I mentioned, are generalist feeders, so they can adapt to a lot of different environments, and they're doing so well, in fact, that in September of 2016, 9 of the 14 worldwide humpback populations were taken off of the endangered species list. I do have to note, however, one of the ones that was not taken off the endangered species list is the Mexico breeding population, which about half of our whales that we know of so far belong to. So, big cause for celebration, humpbacks are recovering, but not completely out of the woods yet, and important to remember that at least a big part of our population here in the Salish Sea is still listed as threatened. Another thing that I kind of want to emphasize is that even though the Hawaii population was taken off the endangered species list, right around when they were announced that they were being taken off the endangered species list, we started to notice the decrease in sightings of that population. In Hawaii, sightings are down 50 to 80% over the last 4 years. And in Glacier Bay, Alaska, sightings in 2018 were the lowest they had been since 2002, with a 50% decrease since 2013. Why? So this is why things like happy whale are really important and matching locations. We don't know if they are dying. We don't know if they're just not reproducing, or if they're just going somewhere else. Because for example, in Hawaii, there's a big decrease in sightings, but if they're going somewhere offshore where there's not a lot of whale-watching boats, then that would explain the decrease in sightings. So we're not sure yet that it's a problem, but it's certainly something that we need to be monitoring.
On your map that you just showed before this, what were the red areas?
So those are the ones that are still listed as endangered.
Okay.
There is kind of... Yeah, there's a Central American population. I would see those whales a lot when I worked in San Diego. They're going down to like Costa Rica and Nicaragua and then up to California in the summertime. Do you know what this one is, Uko, like here? Yeah, I'm not sure what that one is.
Okay.
One of the Oceania populations, and then this one.
Yeah,
that one's unusual because they are not migratory.
Right.
They stay there throughout the year. Very small population, like 100 animals or something like that. It's a small group. But so those are the four that have not been taken off, and then the Mexico one's the only one that's listed as a threatened status.
Do you know if there's been port expansions in those areas for like fishery fleets in the last couple of years or anything? I'm curious because I know Asia's been building up like all of Asia.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure what drove them to decide that they weren't recovered.
Yeah.
I would have to look specifically into that. I selfishly focused on the population that I kind of see, but I'm not sure. So like I said, that's something that we're monitoring. One thing I will say, like I said, part of the question is, are they just going somewhere else and their patterns have changed? At least for these Glacier Bay whales, I've been talking to some of the folks that do research off of Vancouver Island, and they're not seeing them there. We haven't seen them in this population yet. So if they are going somewhere else in the summertime, it's not here. If we're going to be concerned about what's going on with these humpback whales, I'd like to talk about some of the potential threats moving forward, since we now have a very large group of humpback whales in an area that is pretty, when you talk about industrialized, Salish Sea is very much so. This is a great photo of a lunch-feeding humpback whale in the middle of a shipping lane. There's two huge ships in the background, doesn't seem to deter them from feeding. That's where we see them most of the time. But it is a concern. 1 in 10 humpback whales are believed to have been struck by passing vessels in the Atlantic over in the Gulf of Maine. It's really hard to find accurate numbers for that. I tried to find some here in the Pacific, but the truth is people aren't exactly excited to report that they've killed a whale, so you don't get very honest reporting. And in cases of big ships like this, they don't even know they did it. You can't feel it at all. We have no clue, really, the percentage of how many whales are hit, but it certainly does happen. And so that's why it's kind of important to raise awareness, because even, 10 years ago, it wasn't even a factor that these ships had to consider. So we really want to make sure that they're aware that there are whales feeding directly in their path. This, again, shows that. This is, again, the map of where we've seen humpback whales last year, 2018. This, in the corner, is the green are oil tanker traffic. The yellow are passenger ferries, and the red are cargo ships. And you can see that the whales are pretty much exactly in the path of all of those shipping lanes. So, again, a lot of outreach right now is kind of happening as far as trying to let those industries know that there are whales feeding in this area. At the very least, please at least, try to keep an eye out for them.
Do they have any legal obligations to slow down if they know whales are right there?
Yeah, so the question was, do they have any legal obligations to slow down if they know that the whales are right there? No, they sure don't. Yeah, they're considered an exempt group. So ferries, cargo ships, military vessels, things like that, if they're nice, they will slow down, but they're not required to by law. Sometimes, when I was in California, they did a pilot study offering extra incentive, monetary incentive, to ships that would slow down voluntarily in those shipping lanes. The project was really, really successful until they ran out of funding, and then they kind of went back to doing their own thing.
And haven't they, in both Los Angeles and San Francisco, haven't they set up some alternate shipping lanes that they'll say, here's a group of baleen whales, and can you please go around?
Yeah, so I don't know if it's on like a daily basis, but I know that off of the Channel Islands in California, they set up alternative, based on where they would typically see humpback whales and blue whales, they set up an alternative shipping route that they ask the boats to follow, and the boats obliged. Unfortunately, the new shipping route is fin whale territory, but fin whales are currently not endangered, whereas the blue whales were, so, the lesser of the two evils. They kind of pushed it to the fin whale area.
It would be hard to find an alternative.
Yeah, and here, yeah, exactly. I mean, we're talking about massive, massive ships, so you can't really go, like, inner island or anything like that. So I'm not sure what alternatives would be. They have... also, off of Vancouver, and I don't really know the specifics, they were trying to do one of those studies as well, as trying to, entice shipping companies to slow down. I don't know the status on that project. It was really pretty recent. But it seems like money talks, and if you can pay them extra to slow down, they will. But, time is money, and so if they're used to staying on a certain schedule, if they slow down, they could be losing funds, and so you have to kind of compensate them for that. But that was very effective in California. So ship strikes. Last year, we had at least two that we know of. In August, a humpback whale was hit near the mouth of the Salish Sea, near Nia Bay. Another in November washed up near the Tsawwassen Ferry Terminal near Vancouver. And this whale was photographed in 2006. Her nickname is Flash, as you can probably see why. That's a very fresh propeller wound from a smaller boat. So I'm not just talking about large vessels. Small vessels are also very dangerous, especially because they're moving usually pretty fast and don't know that the humpback whales are there. The reason I really want to just emphasize ship strikes, there's been an awful lot in the news lately about orcas and protecting orcas, and legislation we're anticipating is going to go into effect in the next month or two that's going to require slowing down in the vicinity of orcas specifically. Really wish that would be around all whales. Not that you can always be aware of where those whales are, but I know that in our experience, at least, when we're on scene watching whales and boats see us and zoom by giving us a big finger, I know that they know whales are there, and they just don't care. And I wish there was some type of repercussion for that. The NOAA guidelines that apply to humpback whales, don't permit harassment, but it's really hard to prove that, like, what is harassment. But a speed limit is something that you can enforce a little bit easier. So maybe it'll eventually go in that direction. But as of right now, the law that will be going in place in Washington State will only apply to orcas specifically.
Did they ever make an idea on that Tsawwassen humpback?
No, it was too deteriorated to ever figure out who it was. Yeah, it was a juvenile, I think, smaller. So the other really big threat for humpback whales is entanglement. The Department of Fisheries and Oceans partnered with the Marine Education and Research Society, and they found that based on scarring on the flukes of these humpback whales, about half of the humpbacks in British Columbia have been entangled at least once in their life. This is a photograph of a young whale that we saw a lot during the winter of 2017 down in Puget Sound, Speckles, if any of you remember that whale. Really obvious and fairly recent, it looks like, entanglement scarring. Entanglement in things like crab pots, ghost nets, like nets that have been discarded, as well as in British Columbia at least, there's been a few cases of whales getting tangled up in abandoned fish pens, so fish farm pens. Some of those have been fatal. So humpbacks by nature are really tactile and curious, and they'll kind of, you'll see them rubbing up against kelp and things like that. I can easily imagine how they might rub up against a rope and end up getting entangled. So that was Speckles. And then in the Glacier Bay area of Alaska, where I mentioned that those sightings have decreased, by doing a similar study and examining photographs of whales, they found that 71% looked like they had unambiguous entanglement scars. And I wanted to show a picture of this animal because it doesn't get any more unambiguous than this. This is a whale, BCX700, and when we first saw this whale a couple of years ago, we actually called it in because we thought that it was an active entanglement. But when we did submit those photographs, Cascadia came back to us and said that they'd actually first documented that whale with that scarring in 2001. I'd like to say I guess it's not an active entanglement. I feel like if it was still entangled, it would have passed away by now. But it's really, very deep cuts there. You can see lights kind of feeding in the groove. So that whale has survived, at least 18 years with that scarring. So I would say that ship strikes and entanglement are probably the top two, most immediate threats, but there are some others as well. Pollution is a twofold threat. One is from toxins, and again, a lot of this has been talked about in the news lately about orcas, but as they're feeding, all the little plankton that they're eating, all the little bait fish, each bioaccumulate toxins. And so as they're feeding and feeding, they're just storing those in their blood where a lot of them are fat soluble. So while they're feeding, it's not that much of an issue. But when they're making those long migrations for months at a time, they're not eating. They'll lose up to a third of their body weight each time that they migrate. So we're talking about 20,000 pounds that they might lose. And it's when they start to lose that weight and bust into those fat stores that they start to metabolize those toxins. So that's one way that pollution is hurting them. But the other one is just physical. As they are feeding, they are ingesting plastics and other types of garbage, and that's going to cause blockage that will eventually lead to death. This is a bummer of a photo that I took last year. I didn't even notice it at the time, but we were watching this humpback whale feed, and a couple of yards away are latex balloons. I think they have the number 50 on them. It's either someone's anniversary or birthday or something like that. But bummer. We usually try to pick up balloons when we have an opportunity, but because of the proximity to that animal, we weren't able to get over there and do it. But if any of you follow the Balloons Blow group on Facebook, balloons are horrible. There's so many other things you can do to celebrate fun activities than kill whales. So please use something other than balloons. And then the final one is just a little bit of food for thought. Prey availability as a threat. If you remember that chart I showed you, this huge population of humpback whales is a pretty recent phenomenon. I'm going to say 10 years, maybe even closer to 5 years. And a lot of animals in the Salish Sea depend on the food that these humpbacks are eating. A humpback whale can eat at least 2,000 pounds of food a day. I told you. We had 258 sightings, 400 unneed individuals. There's a lot of humpbacks here eating an awful lot of food. Are they going to have enough food to sustain this population long term? That's one question. The other question is, are they hurting other animals by being here? I'm certainly glad to have humpbacks here, but are they harming other whale populations especially? Forage fish are consumed by salmon. Southern resident killer whales eat salmon. As you know, southern resident killer whales are endangered, not doing very well, and food is thought to be the primary reason that they're not doing very well. Is having a whole bunch of humpback whales eating that food source going to be detrimental in the long run? I don't know. But it's, like I said, just something to kind of consider. In nature, there are winners and losers. And right now, humpbacks are winning, but that means someone else is probably losing. So it's just something to keep in mind. But that's all I have. So if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer those. Yeah. Yeah, so the thing about the breeding grounds, they're not really eating when they're there. So we think that they're opportunistic. So if they happen to come across food while they're migrating, they'll eat it. But for the most part, they're not, and they're going months without eating. So that's certainly something to look at, but the idea, at least, is that they are going to breeding grounds to breed and that they're not really eating while they're in the breeding ground. Yeah.
Has there been any studies, and maybe Happy Whale be able to do it, so if our humpbacks are going to Hawaii and Mexico, mm-hmm. and sometimes crossing over, the populations in the Antarctic, because from my understanding, is part of them go up the west side of South America and the other part go up the east side.
Yeah.
Have any notice of any crossover in that?
So the only thing I can say is that they don't have a ton of matches yet for humpbacks in Antarctica to non-Antarctic places. They've matched them across the years in Antarctica. But when I was just there a couple weeks ago, Ted mentioned that of the Antarctic Peninsula population that we were photographing, yes, some of them have been matched to South America and some have been matched to Oceania. So I think it's another similar area to here where it's a really great feeding ground, and so they're kind of overlapping.
But it'll be interesting to see eventually some of the ones that have gone to Oceania.
Oh, if they go somewhere
else. On the other side of South America.
Yeah, you just all have to go to Antarctica and take lots of pictures so we can figure it out.
How you were saying that the age, they live about 80 years or so. How long are they fertile? How many years can they produce kids?
Good question. So this is another thing I was talking to Fred Sharp about in when I was down in Antarctica, because with orcas, we know that they go through menopause, so they are not, you know, reproducing throughout their life. They kind of cut off, you know, similar to ours, about, you know, 40s, 50s. But he said that based on necropsies that they've done on adults, you can, so every time they produce a calf, it produces scarring. Mm-hmm. And based on that scarring, it looks like they're producing until the bitter end.
Wow.
But he did say that the rate might, you know, increase. So whereas typically they are reproducing every 2 years or so, 2 to 3 years, 3 years probably more likely, maybe it will stretch out to, you know, 6 years, 7 years, who knows. But he's pretty sure that they can reproduce until the end. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
With the big groups that are out in the street, when they go down, you don't know what they're doing. Has anybody ever dropped a hydrophone in to listen for any vocalizations?
I don't know if they've dropped it down when they're actually on the dive. We don't hear a lot of vocals here, but we've heard some. There's been like one case of calls that were picked up on the limekiln hydrophone. And then you'd have to ask Lisa. I said I wasn't on the boat that day. She said that they put the hydrophone in and picked up unusual vocalizations, but I'm not really sure what that means underwater. Not a song, but you know, something.
Yeah, yeah. That's the way I asked, because when they bubble net, you know, they have that loud trumpet before it coming up. So I didn't know if they were actually feeding down there. Are they doing something similar to that?
Yeah, I don't know. So something that this year maybe we'll get to try. I'm not sure, but yeah, we do have hydrophones on board, so if the opportunity arises, we'll try to pop them down. Yeah.
Erin, because you're talking about those pairs, these friends, associates, whatever you want to call them, do you see them feeding cooperatively somehow together, or do you?
So I think that they're cooperating because they're coming up at the same time. So they'll both go down together, and then they'll both simultaneously lunge up. So I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's happening under there, but yeah, I'm assuming, and that might be the reason that they do choose to pair up. I'm assuming there's some type of benefit in being in a pair. But yeah, when we've seen them feeding, and I have to be honest, we don't see them like lunge feeding very often. A lot of times they're feeding like under the surface, but when we do see them lunging up, yeah, they come up at the same exact time together, both with moms and calves and the two adults together that are coming up at the same time. Yeah. One of the other things that I'm interested in addition to family dynamics and seeing if they're interacting with family, is seeing if there's a reason that they're preferring one traveling companion over another. Like I said, we've seen some female-female pairs. We thought that Split Fin and Split Fluke were a male-male pair, which made a lot of sense to us until Split Fluke wasn't male, and so that kind of went out the window. So that's another thing that I'm just kind of, you know, do they prefer to travel with, you know, adults that showed up in the same year that they showed up and things like that? I'm not sure, but over the next several years, that's something I kind of hope to see if there's any patterns that emerge. Yeah, Sam?
What is the status on long-term satellite tagging of humpback whales in this area? Is that something that's done to try to figure out if they're moving locations like that?
Yeah. And so for those of you that were here at last month's talk, we were the person here that was in charge of developing those tags. But a couple of times that we've been out there last year, we photographed whales that had scarring from satellite tags, and we did photograph at least one whale that was actively tagged. And when I reached out, they went back to Oregon State, Bruce Mates project. And so they had tagged the whale that I thought was still actively tagged way out off the coast of Washington, and it had come into the Victoria area, kind of south of Victoria. They don't do a ton of tagging. They only stay in for like a month or so. They're not super, super long term. So I'm not sure what, I didn't ask a ton of questions about what he was specifically studying, but he just told me that if I see any others that are tagged or that have scars of previous tagging, they want to know because they'd like to also know how the scars are healing. Yeah. You can go first. Go ahead. In the green, yeah.
Okay. So, has the decline in humpback whale sightings only been observed in the Pacific Ocean, or is it going around the world? I was not clear on that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of have only talked to people that are, you know, in the Pacific, because that's what I've been focused on for the last several years. I know that when I just went to Antarctica, sightings there are increasing exponentially. So I don't know, but I just know that those are the, mostly because I have friends that work in Hawaii and friends that work in Alaska, so I know that they're.
We have someone in Norway, you're working with humpbacks in Madagascar, right?
Yeah, I do my PhD in Madagascar. So I'm wandering now.
Okay.
And now I'm looking all the sightings that I said in all the thousands.
Okay.
So not in Antarctica, but more in the breeding.
Yeah. And in Madagascar, is it increasing or?
Yeah. So the thing is, Madagascar is a part of the population because it's the southern westward Indian Ocean population. So it's Madagascar, but not only.
Yeah.
It's from south of South Africa, you have Maya, Comoros, Madagascar, Mascarene Island, so it's big population.
Yeah, okay.
So it's more complex.
Okay.
And do not know, we do not have a lot of recapture each year because it's really big population.
Okay.
And we know we have a lot of exchanges between all the super regions.
Okay.
So it's hard to know, but
yeah.
We know that it's the weight is pretty good.
Okay, cool.
But for example, in Brazil, you have a good reproduction rate and the percentage, yeah.
Okay, cool, yeah.
Just have to think.
Cool. Scott, did you have a question?
Yeah, on the local hydrophone network, we've heard them in Harrow Street, 2013, 14, 17 at least, but mostly in October.
Okay.
Maybe once in December at night.
Okay.
But I'm wondering if you can think of anything that seems to happen in October.
Well, so
might
what
be
we've
different.
Been kind of thinking is we have noticed over the last several years they're staying later and later. And so they used to be gone in September, then they used to be gone in October, and now they're leaving in late November, and some of them aren't leaving at all. And singing is a breeding thing, we think. And if they're staying into the time of year that they would normally be starting to breed, we have been curious if they're communicating up here in ways that they would maybe as they were going down there. I think 2017 is the one that I was thinking of that we knew that it was captured on a hydrophone locally. But yeah, so that was kind of the speculation. We don't have a ton to to know. But they have been staying later and later to the point that this year we were like, guys, gotta go. They babies. And you can't stay here all winter. Yeah.
The peak on the outer coast for singing is fall.
Okay.
And it's extending into December.
So.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any correlation between the song variation between the, say, the populations, the ones we see here, go to Hawaii or to Mexico? Is there any
I wouldn't even pretend to know. I do know that, like with blue whales and humpbacks and things like that, that's how they kind of distinguish which population is which. Their songs do vary, but eventually their songs catch up to each other.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that they are different, but I just don't even know who's looking into that. Yeah.
I have a question about the gray whales. So if you're seeing an increase in the humpbacks, what is your thoughts on the gray whales?
Yeah, so our gray whale population, I should do an encore talk. my second favorite type of whale here. The gray whales, we have a kind of very interesting population here. It's the same 12 whales that have been coming here for 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, literally. So it's the same 12. They are eating ghost shrimp that burrow in the mud, so they're not really competing for resources. This year is unusual in that we think that much like the humpback whale population that increased and now those whales have to find new food sources, we think that this year is a year that there's probably not a ton of food. And so we have seen, in addition to our 12 whales that come year after year, there's been more, including whales that are perishing. There's been at least 7 dead gray whales that have washed up in Washington as recently as about yesterday in Elliott Bay, 2 days ago in Elliott Bay. 2 days ago. And in California, my friend that does the census down there, they've had at least 20 dead animals. So it happens. There are 25,000 gray whales. What's that? There's limited resources. So they're believed to be at carrying capacity. And so every couple of years there's kind of a correction event where we'll see a lot of strandings, usually in young animals that, you know, maybe don't know the best feeding spots and things like that, and so they're the first to go. The whale that passed away in Elliott Bay was an adult, but empty stomach, looked to be in poor body condition. So at this point, I'm not, you know, alarmed, but if it becomes a repeating trend year after year, then I would be. But like I said, gray whales are believed to be at carrying capacity. There are as many gray whales as can be sustained in the population. So they don't compete with each other, but that's probably the reason that we get more gray whales here, and that's why the humpbacks are here, is there might not be resources elsewhere, so they're looking for new food sources. Okay, one more. Yeah, go ahead.
This is always the big mystery for me with salmon and other migratory mammals.
Yeah.
You have some thoughts about how in the world they find Hawaii, or on their way back find here?
So they think it's acoustic.
Okay.
They think it's acoustic as far as producing sounds that are bouncing off of underwater features. I'm not sure which paper, but I remember I went to a talk a couple of years ago where they were kind of showing the migration of the whales from Alaska to Hawaii, and it's not a straight shot. It's like to this female, and this female, and this female, and stuff like that. And again, this is coming from Fred Sharp, so I haven't seen it in print, but I trust Fred Sharp. Magnetic also. Magnetic and celestial. So that is for humpback whales. Gray whales, I have always kind of read that that is pretty geographic, because they're so coastal, they literally follow the beach. And that's why they sometimes end up in harbors, is because they will just keep following the beach and end up in marinas and things like that. But for humpbacks, acoustic as well as celestial and magnetic. Yeah.
By celestial, do you mean looking at the star?
Sure do. Yeah. Pretty cool. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Based on the database, on the databases of humpback whale photos, has there ever been a humpback whale observed traversing from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere, or vice versa? Because I was reading something about that with mink whales.
Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I think no.
It's tricky though, because there's some of the Antarctic Peninsula.
Yeah.
That crossed the equator to
Costa
Rican dome, right?
They may physically cross the equator.
Yeah, because they go to the
center. Yeah, but it's at like different times of year
as
the other ones. So like the ones from, like say, California that go down to Central America are kind of right there at the equator, and ones from Antarctica will go up there as well, but they're not going there at the same time.
Maybe that's not what you meant.
Yeah, but like they might physically swim across the equator, but we don't think that they're like migrating across the We might get kicked out of
here. Oh, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.